Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Delaware's language immersion program in public schools, launched in 2012, continues to grow and draw attention.
It is groundbreaking at the level that it's taking place at the whole state. The extent that it's being launched and adapted in Delaware is something that is very unique.
We chat with a Delaware State University professor set to study just how effective that language immersion program is. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also hear from a Harbison area resident who backs Artesian Water and Alan Harim's plan to change the way wastewater from a chicken plant is handled. Our latest arts playlist focuses on a new book chronicling the relationship between a Marine vet and the stray dog he brought home from Afghanistan. Plus, a look ahead at the upcoming holiday shopping season. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Artesian Water has been given the go-ahead to construct a new wastewater treatment and storage facility north of Milton. Once it's finished, poultry giant Alan Harim will stop discharging its treated wastewater into Beaver Dam Creek and send it to Artesian's facility instead. That water will then be sprayed onto several fields in Milton. Many residents in the area oppose this plan, worrying their wells could be contaminated. But a resident who lives next to Beaver Dam Creek says this move by the two partners will actually help clean up the creek. Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus sat down with that resident, Jeanette Wagner, to talk about what she has seen in the creek over the years and what she thinks of Alan Harim and Artesian's agreement.
Jeanette, how long have you lived in Harbison for?
We moved in Harbison in 1960, October 1960. So our daughter was 13 months old. That's how I remember. And this is what the stream looked like. It was completely out of control, and we did not have DENREC at that time. It was the State Board of Health. I had them down here several times complaining, and I continued to complain when the other chicken plants came into the area. So been around a long time, and I do have other articles that were in the paper. I have one here that says Harbison Fighting Stinky Town Image, and that was by a Dennis Forney. And we have an organization, and it's called the Harbison Improvement Association. And while all this pollution was going on, we were pretty well organized. We had dinners and we had yard sales in order to obtain a lawyer. They wanted to put a rendering plant up in Harbison. And so we were opposed to it, and the zoning was approved, but they never went through with it. So we were thankful for that.
How close do you live to Beaver Dam Creek?
You're pointing at
your backyard. It's right in your backyard.
Yeah, it's in the side yard. Our property line is the middle of the stream or the creek. We are a property owner, and that was another thing I couldn't quite understand, and I still don't really like the idea that we own it, but people can abuse it. And if we did that to our neighbor's yard, I think we'd be arrested.
What was the quality of the water getting discharged into the creek back then?
All right. When we moved here in 1960, the stream was blocked with debris and was really not a stream because it was going everywhere but where it should have been going. So we would see different, the water quality was bad, discolored. We would see chicken parts. We put a board across the culvert that runs under Route 5. And as you can see by the picture, there were all kinds of junk in there. I called the State Board of Health. They came down. There was no DENREC at that time. And they more or less insinuated, well, they told me that it wasn't due to the chicken plant because it was wild dogs that did this. Well, I did not believe it. I mean, it's very evident that wild dogs did not do this. First of all, they don't have, you know, they'd eat the whole thing. They wouldn't leave just what I'm showing you here today, which is just leftover waste from chickens. So that's what we saw. That was That was 1976. That was before Cargill took over. And so since then, Cargill, Allens, Cargill was an abuser also. Allens were more good neighbors. I'm sure there was things coming down the stream. We would get odors, but as far as the water has been pretty clean after Cargill left. So I really haven't had to contact Denrec like I used to. What I saw back in the 60s and the 70s was horrible.
So seeing these chicken parts wrapped around, it looks like, a piece of wood kind of in front of a small little tunnel. I mean, what was your reaction at the time? Do you remember sort of what went through your mind?
Well, we would see it. We would see parts. And so my husband and I decided we would put a board in front of the culvert that runs under 5. This eventually would have gone into the Broadkill River. And so I just thought, we'll just do it and see what we catch. And this is what we caught. We did not touch these. This is where the water was higher than the board. And the board just happened to catch it. But the water would be higher than what this picture shows. This is mud right here. So that's it.
And were you grossed out at all looking at that in person years and years ago?
Yeah, I was. I was also mad that the state would allow something at that time and then to tell me that it was wild dogs. I mean, I'm not that naive.
And, I mean, when you were making phone calls to Denrec, it was a different company, not Alan Harim, that was discharging.
That's correct. I have not called, I don't think, for Alan Harim. One of the big things that people were complaining about is the noise at the plant. That doesn't bother me as much as the pollution of the water. I mean, it can't be helped. It could be helped if they moved it to a different, their cooling stations for the chickens or whatever you want to call it, if they moved it to a different location. But I don't get so upset with it as I do the pollution of the water. And when I see what they, what has been there and how they have cleaned it up, right now I don't have any reason to complain.
And so why get a hold of all these newspaper articles and why save them, about the contamination, the stench? Why save all these?
The reason I save them is because we own half of the stream. We have an organization now that has been, I'm going to say, opposing, not fighting, the chicken plant over the years with numerous things, not just the stream, with the traffic and the noise and everything. But because this is on our property, I have saved everything. So that's the reason. Because we at one time, we did go to court. The chicken plant wanted a rendering plant up there. And as you can see by these pictures, we did not want it. I'm glad that I saved everything because it just shows, what we went through for years and years and years. And it was actually terrible. When we went to get our mortgage on this house, so this was before 1960, this was in 1959, I went to the president of a local bank and I told him we wanted to borrow money to buy this house. And he said to me, Jeanette, you don't want to buy that house because of the chicken plant. But guess what? We bought the house. Never been sorry. So that's the reason.
So, Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control issued Alan Harim a notice of violation in November 2016 for, the quality of the wastewater it was discharging into Beaver Dam Creek because they had, exceedances in ammonia and phosphorus. So, Alan Harim was ordered out of the creek and they're partnering with Artesian to pipe their wastewater up to a facility north of Milton. It'll be stored there and then sprayed onto several fields in the town. It gets Alan Harim out of Harbison Creek. What do you think of the plan?
I think it's a great plan. Then I won't have to call DENREC all the time or write letters or attend meetings. But I think it's the best thing for the creek, really, because that is such a small one. I think it's a great plan because for the amount of chickens that they're processing now and the water that is used, there's no way this creek would be able to stand all that water. It would flood our yard.
So, I mean, do you think essentially that the quality of this creek will be able to be preserved?
Probably the creek is going to dry up. I'm not sure, unless we have heavy rains or something like that, because it's a natural stream. When we first moved up here and when my husband and his friends started cleaning the stream, which my husband has cleaned it up until just a few years ago by himself in our area since we own half of it. And the sand is just as light as it can be. It's beautiful. It's almost white sand that is under the surface of the muck and all the debris that gets in the creek.
Thanks to Jeanette Wagner and Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus for their time on The Green this week. And the holiday shopping season is apparently already upon us, 2 weeks ahead of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. What can retailers and shoppers expect this year? Contributor Eileen Dalabrida joins us next to offer some insight. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. There was a time when the last vestiges of Halloween candy were consumed before the holiday shopping season got started. Now retailers are already trying to get people in the holiday spirit before the last trick-or-treat is uttered by a costumed kid, offering Black Friday deals weeks before Black Friday. So how is the holiday shopping season shaping up for retailers, and what can shoppers expect? Contributor Eileen Dalabrida took a look at the lay of the land for us, and her piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joins me now to talk about what she found in her work. Hi, Eileen. How you doing?
Great, Tom. Glad to be here.
Well, over the years, we have talked about the traditional holiday shopping season that used to start with Black Friday. That's kind of gone by the wayside. It seems more true than ever this year. Halloween barely over, and it seemed so-called Black Friday deals were already popping up everywhere in stores and online. This is not my imagination. The push keeps moving back further and further, doesn't it?
It is creeping ever backward.
So what is the outlook for retailers this holiday shopping season?
It's a very cheerful outlook. The only question is, how prosperous will it be? Every prediction has sales accelerating, with some analysts predicting the merriest Christmas since 2005.
That's pretty impressive, and that's kind of surprising considering, I guess, in some ways, you know, people still maybe feeling uneasy, but I guess what your story found was that maybe not so much.
There's a lot of consumer confidence. The stock market is doing really well. Also, saving rates are down a little bit, but also the jobless rate is the lowest since 2000, and that also gives people a lot of optimism.
Is there a sense of, in those predictions you talked about, just how big it could be this year?
Well, the most optimistic numbers predict a 6% increase, and that's really significant. And on even the low end is around 4%.
So in your piece, you also mentioned that there may be a major benchmark that's reached in that constant tug of war we've seen in recent years between sales in brick-and-mortar stores and sales online. What might we see this year?
This year, we are expecting to see more transactions occur online than in actual stores.
And that's a pretty big deal.
That is a huge deal. Although, it isn't as dire as it sounds for the brick-and-mortar stores, because many of those sales will be from the websites of Macy's and Walmart and Target. And a lot of folks will order things online and then go to the store and pick them up. And hopefully, buy a gift or two while they're there.
I was going to say, brick and mortar stores are still, you know, very much in the game. And as you just mentioned, there is an opportunity perhaps for them to use the online sales as an entree to bring people in and maybe have, you know, those big sales in store as well that might attract people's attention. So brick and mortar stores aren't necessarily going to change their philosophy, right?
They aren't. I think that they know the way that that the wind is blowing as millennials and Gen Xers become a bigger part of the buying public. We have generations that are really, really comfortable using their smartphones to make purchases, and that's not going away.
Is that the major reason for the shift to online is because of the younger millennial Gen X audiences or even just, you know, other people kind of getting more familiar, more comfortable with shopping online?
I think that other people are becoming more comfortable, but the as the millennials and the Gen Xers mature and have more buying power, they are having a greater say in the way business is transacted.
With this all kind of happening, you know, more online now, is there a sense that this could also mean the end of Black Friday as we knew it, or is there still going to be that big push the day after Thanksgiving, or also even like Cyber Monday? You know, are those kind of one day event type of things, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, becoming a little bit more antiquated, or is that still something that retailers look at very, very closely?
I think that they are traditions or have become traditions. Cyber Monday is obviously a lot newer than Black Friday, but I think that it is a tradition for many people. They see it as a fun event to go out and shop on Black Friday. A lot of people are off from work. That's when they there are lots and lots of doorbusters. And it's not clear yet whether or not we'll have a resurgence of the past couple years phenomenon of actually shopping on Thanksgiving Day. I think that might be kind of falling by the wayside a little bit.
And you talk about those doorbusters we've traditionally seen in stores on Black Friday. We're also seeing a lot more of those type of things even already online, kind of the doorbuster kind of migrating online as well.
Yes, and offering promotions online coupons, timed kind of things, like the Black Friday doorbuster in the store might be available for 4 hours or so online. So there is a sense of time and urgency that accompanies getting the big deal no matter where you buy it.
You also mentioned in your piece that Small Business Saturday seems to really be catching on. Tell us a little bit about what you learned about its growth.
Well, I think that people are very much interested in supporting their local business people and finding things that are a little bit different. So they're going to boutiques, going to mom and pop stores, and supplementing that with the big box buys online.
And I imagine for those small businesses, the key is to kind of capture those audiences. When they come in on that maybe Small Business Saturday, find a way to maybe kind of turn them around and keep them coming back.
They are. They're offering loyalty programs. They offer really, in many cases, superb service, so that you just don't get when you're clicking.
So tell us a little bit more about what you learned about when people are shopping during the holiday season and exactly how much we might expect to see them spend during this holiday shopping season.
Well, they are spending more and they are starting earlier. I talked with people who started earlier because they plan to spend more and they wanted to kind of stretch out those purchases. Instead of having that huge credit card bill in December, that they are buying all for months and months, and then spreading it out.
I guess so. The idea is that you don't have that December bill that comes in January and gives you sticker shock. Then maybe you spread it out over November, December, and January.
Yeah, and some people are very disciplined about it. I spoke to one mom who is buying for her two daughters as well as a bunch of nieces and nephews, and she's very disciplined. She buys one or two gifts every time she gets a paycheck, and it's really been a great budgeting tool for her.
And you mentioned more people intend to spend more. That kind of crosses across lines, right? Across economic lines, and maybe people who have more money will spend more. But even people maybe on the lower end of the income scale are expected to spend more. Is that correct?
That is correct, and it might not be on big ticket items, but they know that the deals are out there or will be out there, and they just seem to be feeling a little bit more optimistic this year.
Are there any benefits to waiting to shop, to the procrastinator, or are retailers really kind of leading with their best deals and waiting doesn't necessarily mean you'll get a better deal later? Some people seem to think that, like, well, if I wait and they get desperate, they'll slash the price even more.
I think it depends on what's on your list. If you are looking for something and you want to have a bunch of choices, different, that color sweater that you have to have or whatever, don't wait for inventories to dwindle down. If you see a good deal, grab it. You can always go back and exchange it later if you see the price plummet. I think that that retailers are leading with their best, and there isn't any reason to hold back.
And I guess that also is true for anything that's kind of considered a hot item that could be harder to get. Do we have any sense of what those hot items might be this year?
Well, there are various things in the toy category that are always hot. And Toys R Us and Target are advertising them, as is Amazon. And there are also jewelry is a pretty good category, accessories and apparel.
And, of course, always the electronics. Those are, I guess, where you traditionally see some of those big doorbusters, whether it be TVs, computers, things like that. That's almost a kind of a staple these days of holiday shopping, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Anything else that you found interesting as you were kind of delving into this year?
Well, I think that one of the things that we're going to see, if you are shopping in the stores, is that there will be fewer people to help you. That seasonal hiring has shifted from the store to the warehouse where they will be fulfilling those online orders. So I think that that might be a problem. I don't know whether or not the brick-and-mortar stores are getting it right. I think that if you don't have people to wait on customers, that kind of drives them to their laptops. So we'll see how that works out.
You're going to have to kind of find that sweet spot, having just enough people there to make the service good enough, but also understanding that maybe you don't have as many people to serve. It's very interesting. And obviously, we even know here locally, Amazon has really ratcheted up its hiring for the holiday season at its fulfillment center. So there's no doubt there is that shift going on. Eileen, thank you so much for taking time this week to tell us about what's going on with holiday shopping.
Thanks, Tom.
And once again, you can find Eileen's piece right now on holiday shopping at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Our arts playlist is on the way. Kelly Steele has a conversation with a Marine vet about his new book on a stray dog he brought back from Afghanistan and how it changed his life. But first, a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In a remote part of Afghanistan in 2010, U.S. Marine Sergeant Craig Grossi fed a piece of beef jerky to a funny-looking stray dog. A few days later, when it was time for Grossi's unit to be airlifted out, the dog, newly dubbed Fred, was on the helicopter with the unit. It was the first leg of an international journey to Fred's new home with Grossi's family in the United States. Today, more than 35,000 people follow Craig and Fred's constant adventures on Facebook and Instagram, and a viral story on the dodo last year reached millions more with Fred's amazing backstory. For this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with Craig Grossi about his new memoir, Craig and Fred, A Marine, A Stray Dog, and How They Rescued Each Other.
tell me, this is a fascinating book. I haven't read it yet, Craig. I have to be upfront about that, but I can just tell it's going to be a fascinating book. Give me some background about yourself, and then we'll talk about the book.
Yeah, sure. I grew up in the suburbs of the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., in a little town called Burt, and I joined the Marine Corps in 2003, and I spent 4 years at active duty, and then I got out for a little while, and I ended up getting back in and doing another 4 years, ultimately getting out in 2011. And while I was in, I deployed to Afghanistan, and I ended up in a very remote and isolated and kind of very violent battlefield in an area called Sangin, which is in Helmand Province. And on that battlefield and in the middle of all this conflict, I came across a funny little stray dog that was just kind of too cool to leave behind, and together him and I have been on a wild journey, and that's kind of the subject of the book.
All right, so the book is called Craig and Fred, a Marine, a stray dog, and how they rescued each other. Give us a little bit of background about the book.
Sure. So the story. There's actually two books. There's an adult version, for everyone, and it's more of a memoir, and there's a young reader, which is just kind of formatted a little bit differently, and some of the subjects are just a little more appropriate in terms of language and situations. But they both have the message is very clear, and the story is very much there for both audiences. And the young reader is for ages 8 and up. But it's essentially the story of my life a little bit before the Marine Corps, and just how I ended up in Afghanistan in general is kind of an interesting and unique story, and then specifically how and where I found Fred and kind of the crazy and miraculous way that I was able to get him home. There was just a lot of ways it could have gone really wrong for him and for me, and it's just it's a really powerful story, and to me, it's proof of what is possible when we understand that it's not what happens to us, but how we react that matters. And the little phrase that I kind of coined for Fred is, he was stubbornly positive, and he's kind of taught me how to be stubbornly positive too.
Look, in Afghanistan, there are often, we all know, packs of stray dogs wandering around. U.S. Mm-hmm. military regulations discourage taking care of stray dogs while you're in the field, let alone adopting one and then sending him and naming him back to your family here in the United States.
Right.
How did you go about deciding to rescue Fred, and what did it feel like when you finally succeeded?
Yeah, I mean, he kind of made... I knew I wanted to, but I also knew that it would be risky, and so I kind of left it up to him, and that's a really, that was really important to me. I didn't want to feel like I was, stealing him or making him do something he didn't want to do. So there was a lot of little, and in the book, there's lots of little examples of how he kind of just demonstrated that, he was one of us, and that he wanted to stay with us no matter what. And one of the strongest instances of that was when he followed me to the helicopter. That was just lots of little signs that I was looking for and to really make sure that, I was doing the right thing and not just kind of forcing this dog to do something that maybe he didn't want to. From making that decision and getting him home was just lots of little obstacles and lots of big obstacles, but getting him back to the States, he ended up being about 3 or 4 months ahead of me, and my family took care of him until I got home, and that just was a really special feeling, because I still had about 4 months left on my deployment, and I wasn't sure if I was going to make it back, but I knew I had saved Fred, and I had gotten him home. And that meant everything to me.
I guess I don't have to ask. I can kind of hear it in your voice. But talk about your bond with Fred. And by the way, what kind of dog is Fred?
Yeah. So our bond is, it's obviously really strong. And he's actually my first dog. I've always been a dog lover, but we were a cat family growing up. But I always went out of my way to hang out with the neighbor's dogs. I've made friends, kind of purposely with kids that had dogs when I was a kid. And so, for me and Fred, I think, our, our bond is kind of in the story, a lot of it, and, you know, and just the story that we share and the circumstances of how we came together. But it's not unique in terms of just the way dogs influence our lives and the how important animals are to us and what they do for us. You know, it's really just an immeasurable, force in our lives if we're lucky enough to have them. So I think that's where people can really relate to me and Fred is just everybody loves their animals. And in terms of what kind of dog he is, I think that I always like hearing people's interpretations. He gets a lot of corgi. People always kind of think he's a corgi, but I didn't really see any corgis running around the battlefields over there. And I attributed his characteristics down to just he's definitely a hound because he's so loud and he's got a really great nose and really good eyes. And he's definitely a shepherd because he's a little bossy. I think he's pretty sure he's just herding me around everywhere we go. And I just drive the car and he kind of tells me where to turn. I think that's how he sees it. So, I think he's definitely just part hound and part shepherd. But one of these days I'll get around to doing his DNA.
So, Craig, you and Fred were actually in Rehoboth Beach yesterday at Browse About Books, signing copies of your books. And everybody got to pet Fred. I'm sure that was exciting.
I haven't been to Rehoboth Beach in a really long time, and we're really, really excited to get there. And it sounds like a great store and a great community in general. So we have a really cool paw print stamp that is actually made from Fred's paw print. And so, so he can sign each book too. And that's what people really want. Nobody cares about my signature. So it'd be really exciting. Yeah.
How cool. Hey, Craig, you're a serviceman. I want you to address some issues facing veterans today. Veterans, a big issue here in the state of Delaware. Mm-hmm. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. I mean, I think that veterans issues, are people's issues. We all kind of go through transitions in life, and the circumstances for veterans are just kind of elevated in terms of the severity of the transition. And I think a lot of us kind of are given these high expectations and kind of for what the transition is supposed to look like in terms of how long and how straightforward, and you're kind of thrown a lot of different resources, and you're given a lot of business cards, and you go to a lot of meetings, and everybody says they want to help, and then when the dust settles, it's really easy to feel kind of lost. And I think that for me, what I've been trying to figure out for years now is just like what my transition is supposed to look like. And I don't think that that any one transition for a veteran is the same, and I think that's really important. I think that sometimes it feels like we're supposed to have figured it out by now. Like a year or two after you get out, you're supposed to have a good job, have it all kind of squared away. And if you don't, there's something wrong with you. And I think, that's kind of a harmful kind of mentality. And for me, that was something I struggled with in terms of just, feeling kind of useless and powerless. So I think just for veterans and for people, who are serving us, or people, that have a veteran in their life, I think, it's just important to kind of remind them that, it's going to take a while and that's okay. What ultimately matters is that you end up, doing something that is, you love, or, that just gives you satisfaction, because that's what we had in the military. We had a job and we had a community that we really loved. Even if you didn't deploy, even if you're not a combat veteran, like, it's still, a real big shock that to leave that community and to leave that field that you were in, where you really had a sense of purpose. And it's not something that you can't find again. It's just you can't put a timeline on it. It's something that you have to kind of be patient with.
Thanks to Marine Corps veteran and author Craig Grossi and R. Kelly Steele for their time on this week's Arts Playlist. If you'd like to read more about Grossi's story and his new book, go to our website, DelawarePublic.org. And The Green wraps up in just a moment with this week's Enlighten Me, where we meet a Delaware State University professor who's launching a study of the Language Immersion Program in Delaware Public Schools. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In 2011, then-Governor Jack Markell created an initiative launching dual-language immersion programs in the state's public schools, starting at the kindergarten level. There are now 12 school districts in the first state offering these programs, some of which teach Chinese and others which teach Spanish. The state considers them a success, and they continue to expand to more schools and up the K-12 ladder. But just how well are they working? And are they making a measurable difference with the students involved? Those are questions Delaware State University Assistant Professor of Applied Linguistics, Dr. Brody Blumel, hopes to answer. Blumel was recently awarded a three-year grant of more than $240,000 by the U.S. Department of Education to research the effectiveness of these programs so far. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino speaks with Blumel about his approach to evaluating language immersion and the potential benefit Delaware could see from implementing these programs on an unprecedented scale.
Specifically, looking at what the learning model is and how it's been adapted in the school districts here in Delaware, and also to look in detail about content learning through the languages that the students learn, as well as learning of the language itself. The project will be partnering with several different school districts throughout Delaware. That's still in the works right now, establishing those partnerships, but at least two school districts from each of the three Delaware counties that will go in and look at the immersion programs in each of those districts, which vary quite a bit based on region simply because of the student population in each of those areas.
Is Markell's program kind of groundbreaking and unprecedented? Have we seen anything else like this in the country that we can draw from, or is this all brand new?
It's not necessarily all brand new in terms of having these immersion classrooms, but it is groundbreaking at the level that it's taking place at the whole state. So there are places in California, in Utah, in Washington states where they have these bilingual immersion classes at the state school district levels, but they're isolated in one or two school districts, or more often found in private schools. The extent that it's being launched and adapted in Delaware is something that is very unique, that it was launched again at the state level, that the State Department of Education has a model for implementing the immersion programs, that they support this in the schools. And as of this year, there are 12 school districts in the state of Delaware that have implemented immersion learning beginning in kindergarten, and that there are still several more districts in the state that plan to. So the extent that it's taken over and been implemented is something that is very groundbreaking.
You were talking earlier about your research in both students' ability to learn a new language as well as absorb the other content in the classroom. Just as referencing the programs that are already in place in California and Utah, what have we seen so far? Are students still keeping up with their other subjects while learning Spanish or Chinese?
Yeah, it's not so much a question of whether they keep up with the subjects. It's a matter of what approaches are best to help them learn those subjects. So there's been some challenges and benefits in specific content areas. We're focusing in on math. So through the Delaware model, students begin learning math through I don't want to say second language, it's not always the second language, but whether they're in a Chinese immersion program or the Spanish immersion program, they learn math through Chinese or through Spanish beginning in kindergarten. And in other models, specifically in Utah, they had it set up to learn math through the target language initially, and then found it more effective for them to change and learn math through the first language instead. And that was one approach. In other locations, they've taken different approaches, and so it's not so much a matter. At this point, we don't have the answer of what approach is best, and that's something that we're really wanting to look at to discover.
And as of right now, is there one standardized approach here in Delaware?
Yeah, so in Delaware, we have the Delaware model, where students spend half of their day in the target language and half of their day in English. And in, again, whether it's Chinese or Spanish, they learn that language, so either Chinese or Spanish language arts. They also learn math and science as well, and then they spend their English portion of the day studying English language arts, social studies, and then they also have a bridging lesson where they apply a lot of the concepts that they've learned in math and science in their target language. They apply those concepts and additional practices in English. And I'm hesitant to say their first language versus second language because it varies on population. So in southern Delaware, where there's a larger population of native Spanish speakers, many of these classrooms are composed about 50-50 of Spanish first language speakers who are learning English and English first language speakers who are learning Spanish. So depending on the region of the state and the student body there, depends on whether Spanish or English is their first or second language.
How does your research approach determining what the most effective model is?
Initially, we're really starting at the basic here in terms of establishing what the model is and how it's working, and then identifying the specific challenges that are being had with it and how they can be addressed. So we're not necessarily setting out to research and say, is the model we have in place the best model as compared to what, but rather identifying this is the model in place, what are the challenges that it has, what are the strengths that it has. Bilingual immersion education in the U.S. really has limited research at this point to point us to the most effective models. We have in the research a few different models that we can apply or follow, but not a strong standpoint that says this model is the best because, or this approach is the best because. And so what we're really looking to do is document to a large extent the approach that's taking place here and identify the strengths and weaknesses of it.
Where do you see this going in the future? I mean, this is, like you say, sort of a groundbreaking scale on which a state is taking on this immersion program. Do you see this catching on across the country?
It is. It's an exciting time and a good time to be here in Delaware as we really do stand to be the leaders throughout the country in terms of implementing bilingual education. So as I mentioned, there are a few other pockets where this has been going on for several years, but there are a lot more pockets that are looking to implement and create such programs. And so the research we're doing here, the work that's being done by the State Department of Ed, as well as all of the school districts that have these programs, is really laying out a model that other regions in the country will be able to look to and to learn from as they move forward in beginning such programs themselves.
Now you have this grant money. Where does it go to? When do you get started with your work?
So the project started officially a month ago already, so it was October 1st, and all of the funds that were collected are purely for primarily being expended to for the researchers involved, and at the end we'll be creating a resource that's freely available online for any and all parties that are interested in bilingual immersion, from researchers to school districts to just parents who are interested. So we're going to be observing these classes, see what's going on, and then also recording and documenting that, and then creating what's called a corpus of bilingual immersion classrooms where we document all that's happening in those classes and then make that data available freely to the public.
All right. Anything else you'd like to add?
Just that I'm very excited about the project. It stands not just as an opportunity to establish the wonderful work that's being done here in the state, but to really emphasize the strengths that we have to draw from our immigrant population, from those who speak a different language, and also the capacity for the monolingual population in the U.S. to really grow their mindset and capacity by learning an additional language and by association learning additional cultures. So while the research aspect, looking specifically at the education model, is exciting, what's a lot more exciting is to see how this has the capacity to change our culture and to make some very, very powerful changes in influencing our society in that way.
Thanks to DSU Assistant Professor of Applied Linguistics, Dr. Brody Blumel, and R. Nick Schellino for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Katie Pikus, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be off the next couple of weeks, but we'll return in December with more of The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.